Hi, and welcome back to the Apology Podcast. I'm Jesse Pearson, the founder and editor of Apology Magazine. Today's guest is the film critic A.S. Hamra. I think there's a case to be made for film criticism being the genre of writing that's devolved the most in recent decades. But Hamra, who's known as Scott to his friends and acquaintances, is one of the saving remnants of the entire enterprise of film criticism. His reviews and essays are erudite, personable, funny, and unsparing. And he'll also turn you on to stuff that might have slipped your radar otherwise. He looks at films not just in and of themselves, but he also has a way of locating them in a larger sense in terms of the cultural and societal climate they come out in. I've recently returned to actually renting DVDs and Blu-rays. Something about leaving the house and choosing something physical, like a physical object, gives me a kind of commitment to watch it that, like, the overdose of choice on streaming services really works against. And Scott's writing has been really handy in this regard. He helps me to choose new and old things to watch and rewatch. Hamra wrote a film column for the journal N Plus One from 2008 until 2019. Now he's a columnist for the journal The Baffler. There's also a book of collected writings called The Earth Dies Streaming, Film Writing 2002 to 2018, and that was published by N Plus One Books in 2018. I can't recommend that book enough. We cover a lot in this interview. Scott is full of references, memories, and associations. So keep a pencil handy. This is one of those episodes that will give you a lot of recommendations for books, but also for movies. So here we go. A.S. Hamra on the Apology Podcast. So what are you reading right now?
I've been mostly watching films. And I started reading a lot of books, you know, I thought I was going to read a lot of books during the pandemic, but I had a lot of trouble reading. And I wanted to read really long books. Like, I was going to reread Underworld by Don DeLillo, and I was going to read Life and Fate by Vasily Grossman. Hmm. And I started these, and I was going to read The Idiot by Dostoevsky for something I was doing. And I read like half of it. And I couldn't concentrate on reading at all. But I did read Ben Hecht's autobiography, A Child of the Century, which is like 650 pages long, and it's great. And so, he's the Hollywood screenwriter that wrote many of the best films ever made.
Yeah, sure.
Kind of invented, what Hollywood screenplays are. And then I read this new book by Nick Davis. That's a dual biography of Herman Mankiewicz and Joseph L. Mankiewicz.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's just coming out this month. And it was very interesting. And it was far more. And Nick Davis is the grandson of Herman Mankiewicz.
Okay.
And he's a documentary filmmaker. And he's married to the novelist Jane Mendelsohn.
I'm not familiar with her.
She wrote I Was Amelia Earhart.
Okay. I know the title. I haven't read it. Have you read that?
Yeah. I have not. I actually did read that in the 90s, but I don't remember it well. And I kind of met them through social media, coincidentally, as I was finishing this Ben Hecht autobiography. And, you know, that book is so much better than Mank, the movie.
I was going to say, it might not be that hard to be better than Mank, the movie.
Well, yeah. But Herman Mankiewicz is the one who invited Ben Hecht to Hollywood with the famous telegram.
Right.
And so Davis's book is called Competing with Idiots from that telegram, which said, that Hecht should come out to Hollywood. You know, there's millions to be made and your only competition is idiots. Don't let this get around. So I read that book, which I enjoyed. It was really, I learned a lot of things about Joseph L. Mankiewicz that I did not know.
Oh, I want to jump back to Ben Hecht for a second. He's fascinating. Do you have a favorite of the films that he wrote, or what comes to mind when you think about him first?
Well, I mean, what comes to mind are the Hawks comedies, 20th Century, with John Barrymore and Carol Lombard, screwball comedy about the theater world, and about a theater actress moving to Hollywood. And His Girl Friday, which is based on the Hecht MacArthur play, The Front Page. And also Notorious, the Alfred Hitchcock film with Cary Grant and Ingmar Bergman.
I didn't know he wrote that. Wow.
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, he wrote many, many great screenplays, and he was uncredited on a lot of stuff. But those are the ones that come to mind the most.
Was there anything particularly surprising about his life, his personal life?
One thing that was, well, he had a family that he abandoned when he was a Chicago newspaper man, which was kind of shocking to read. He had a wife and a child. But he had a job as, he started out in the newspaper world in Chicago in the 19-teens when he was quite young. He quit college and started doing that. And one of his jobs was that he had to go into the houses of people who had just experienced some kind of tragedy. Like maybe a member of their family had been murdered, or maybe a member of their family was a murderer. And he had to go in with a reporter. He wasn't a reporter yet. And he had to steal a photograph.
Oh my God.
Or a picture. Didn't have to necessarily be a photograph, a picture of the person that the story in the news was about.
Wow.
Without the subject or the interviewee noticing that he was doing this.
Wow.
So this was a standard practice at the time. And I don't know if they returned the pictures or not, but then they would publish them in the newspaper.
That's fascinating to me because there's so much debate now about the integrity of the press from one side or the other. And the thing is, newspapers were always very cutthroat, you know, underhanded sort of operations from the beginning.
Yes. And you really get a sense of that in his autobiography. And there's a lot of great stories about attending hangings. There's having to travel through the snow in the Midwest in the middle of the winter to get to some place where a murderer was on the loose.
Mm.
You know, there's a lot of really good stories. And then he became a correspondent in Berlin during the Weimar era, during the period where there were, you know, revolutions in Germany every few months.
Yeah.
He was there for 2 years, and that's a really fascinating part of the book that would make a really good film too. I think.
Did he take part in any of the Weimar decadence?
Well, he observed a lot of it. Yeah, and he wrote a lot about it for the Chicago newspapers, and stories were syndicated in other papers too.
Mm.
It's unclear to what extent he participated in anything like that. Although I'm sure. He writes a lot about prostitutes in the book.
Hmm.
So, you know, I'm sure he participated in that way.
Yeah.
But, you know, he had a really fascinating life and a really fascinating career. Then he lived in Nyack, New York, and I'm actually going there this week. I want to see the house where he lived. He spent half his time in Hollywood and the rest of his time in Nyack.
That's so funny.
And his wife was a screenwriter and a playwright, too, and a novelist also.
Nyack is right on the edge of the Tappan Zee Bridge, I think, right?
Yeah, it's about 40 miles north of here, where I am here in Brooklyn.
Yeah, I've been there. It's cute. What was his wife's name? What did she write?
His wife's name was Rose, and I can't remember her last name right now, nor can I remember which film she wrote. But they weren't films that did very well or that are well known today.
I see.
And she was like a prodigy that he met in Chicago. Before they moved to New York to work on papers in New York. So after he was in Germany, he was back in Chicago, and then eventually they moved to New York and then Hollywood.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, she came from this extremely erudite, very well-educated Jewish family, kind of the opposite of his own family.
Right.
Who were kind of failed tailors from Milwaukee. And he had at one point in his young life, it was thought that he was going to be a violin prodigy. When he was a child, but he abandoned playing the violin to become an acrobat in the circus.
My God, what a life.
Yeah, he had a very interesting life, and the book is quite good, but it's a very, very long book. So I read that, and then I read the Mankiewicz dual biography, which is, you know, and then what else did I read? I read Matthew Spector's new book about kind of his childhood in Hollywood, which is called Always Crashing in the Same Car, which is really a series of essays about kind of obscure Hollywood figures that he interpolates into stories from his own life. It's a lot of it's about screenwriters. So there's something about Eleanor Perry, who wrote The Swimmer.
Mm, okay.
Her husband, Frank Perry, was the director. She wrote most of his screenplays.
The Cheever adaptation.
Yes. And then there was a chapter on Carol Eastman, who was a screenwriter who wrote Five Easy Pieces, who's a really fascinating figure. She wrote under the name Adrienne Joyce. That stuff is really very interesting. There's a chapter on Tuesday Weld, the actress, too.
What was her story? I mean, she's always seemed sort of vanilla to me.
No, she was a real wild girl.
Oh, wow. Okay.
She's like a proto Lindsay Lohan in a way.
Oh, wow.
And she rejected Hollywood. She would come back to make money, but she was very opposed to stardom.
And who is this writer, Matthew Spector? I'm not familiar with that name. You said he grew up in Hollywood? Is he from a film family?
Yes, he's the son of a very famous and successful agent from CAA. And he's written a few novels, and he was the editor of the LRAB. The LARB, the LARB.
The Los Angeles Review of Books.
The Los Angeles Review of Books, yes.
Right, right.
And his story wasn't really as interesting as the subjects he covered otherwise in the book. But it was kind of an interesting way to do a book like that.
Do you find that most of your reading has to do with film, even at least tangentially?
It doesn't normally, but, you know, recently it has. I also read Tarantino's novelization of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood recently.
That I read, too. What did you think of that?
I did not love it. It was a very, very interesting thing for a director to do that. I wish all directors had to novelize their movies.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Ridley Scott or somebody. the book was too illuminating about Tarantino, and a lot of it seemed like it was written by a 14-year-old.
Yeah.
And a lot of it seemed like notes to actors about the characters.
Yeah.
So things you wouldn't normally share in print that you would tell an actor that an actor would be free to use to create the character or to reject seemed to make up a lot of that book. But it was interesting how the book didn't follow the film.
Yeah, it diverged from it.
Yeah, and it was interesting just to do that. And I think that the thing that I liked most about it was that it was a mass market paperback. I wish books would still appear in that size.
I do too. I love, even the design was a bit, you know, was quite retro.
Yeah, I mean, the retro 70s-ness of the design was nice, but, you know, just the size of the book is so pleasurable to read a book that size and to,
it is.
You know, take it places with you.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
I thought it was funny how he took Brad Pitt's character, Cliff, and turned him into this huge cinephile, you know, foreign film nut.
Right. Yeah, it was interesting how he wrote about foreign films in the 1940s playing in the U.S. Tarantino's evocation about foreign films in the post-war period was much more interesting and thorough and accurate than Louis Menand's in his book, The Free World, that came out recently, which I also read. Tarantino really had Menand beat on that. But in a way, the Tarantino novelization spoils the movie by making things too explicit.
I agree, yeah.
You know, and so what you really get out of that book is it shows you in kind of a negative, you know, what the cinema is. Because it's the things that make a film great or make that film work are all the things that aren't in that book.
Yeah, yeah. What's left out, what's hidden.
Exactly. What isn't said or stated.
Yeah. The book...
So I read...
Oh, I was just going to say, yes. that the book feels a lot like... background work, like a peek into sort of his process.
Right, exactly. That's what I meant about talking to the actors. You know, it seems like all stuff that you do to prepare to create these characters more than it does seem like something that is the end result.
Yeah.
Because the movie is the end result, and the novelization is something that is, you know, comes after the movie.
What, were you a fan of the movie?
I did like it, yeah.
Me too.
I liked it quite a bit.
I have a lot of friends who did not like it. In fact, most of my friends did not like it.
I have a lot of friends who didn't like it, too. Yeah, controversial film in many ways. But I thought it was very enjoyable. I saw it twice in theaters.
So you've actually read a lot lately.
So I was on vacation up in the Adirondacks for 2 weeks. I wasn't really on vacation, but I was at somebody's lake house up in the Adirondacks, you know, trying to work up there. And I read those, and then I ran out of books to read, so I had to read books that they had. And I read a book by Barbara Cummins,
uh-huh,
called Who Was Changed and Who Was Dead, which is a novel from the early 50s about a young woman, a teenage girl, really, who lives in a town where there's a flood that floods out everybody's houses, and then a plague starts right afterward that happens from eating moldy rye bread.
Wow.
And all the people in the town start killing themselves in public after they eat this bread.
Moldy rye bread was theorized to have caused like Saint Vitus dance and all those epidemics like that you see Bruegel right. painting.
Yes, and it's also often blamed for the witch the witch trials.
Oh, I didn't know
Salem.
That. Wow.
Yeah,
this novel sounds far out. I've never even heard of this.
Well, it's written by this British writer named Barbara Cummins, which is spelled Comyns, who wrote this amazing novel called The Vet's Daughter, which is a very macabre, kind of gruesome family drama about a young woman again, teenage girl. And it's published by, that book is published by New York Review Books Classics.
Oh, that makes sense.
But this one was not. And the people were, you know, they just had it on their shelf where I was staying. So I read it. And it's short, but it's a very good plague novel. And it's written, she writes in this very kind of innocent, wide-eyed style that's also very ironic and, you know, witty.
Right.
About really horrible, traumatic family events.
Were you able to find parallels between the plague in her novel and the pandemic we were undergoing?
There aren't any explicit ones, but, you know, all things about plagues are interesting now. But
yeah.
Of course, there's people in the novel who don't really believe that it's happening and, you know.
Yeah.
What was interesting about it was in her book, you know, people lose their minds as part of this. So the way that they act is kind of, it has a certain anti-vax quality.
Oh, right.
You know, this push to an extreme.
It sounds like it could become a film too.
That would be a pretty good movie, I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It takes place in a small town in England. That's kind of a rural, rural place. I can't remember the name of the town now. It's about her, you know, she lives with her father and grandfather and her two siblings. And what something that's interesting about this book, it's from the early 50s, is that her sister is black.
Uh-huh.
Because her father was the lover of her late mother who was cheating on her father who's still alive.
It sounds like would it fit in with the kind of the folk horror craze we're seeing happen in the last few years? Folk horror, F-O-L-K, folk.
Oh, yeah. You know yeah, actually it would fit in with that. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it would be a very good film. I don't think people would, it would be a great film now that you mention it. Yeah.
Yeah, this is one that I'm going to get as soon as possible. It sounds really kind of up my alley in some ways.
It was published by that book series, that paperback series of feminist classics, or just maybe just novels by women authors called Virago.
Right, that's great.
In the 1980s.
Oh, wow. I love that word, Virago. Rachel Kushner uses that a lot in her recent essays, actually.
Well, maybe someday she'll be published by Virago if it's ever revived.
Let's move back a bit and talk about your earlier reading experiences. I'm curious to know what your earliest memories are of reading once you were moving into sort of more serious stuff, chapter books, you know, sort of more self-directed things, maybe in middle school, early high school. What do you remember from that time?
Well, I went to public school in a very rural area of Connecticut that's more like going to school. It's more like growing up in New Hampshire or Maine than what people think of as Connecticut, especially people in New York City. When you mention Connecticut, they think you're referring to like Darien and, you know, New Canaan, the very wealthy part of Connecticut that's near New York City.
Yeah.
That's not like where I grew up. I grew up in a more New England-y environment, and it was really a farming town. But it was next to where Wesleyan University is in Middletown. And I, you know, when I was a kid, I just read lots of comic books and I, you know, read Roald Dahl.
Mm-hmm.
I read, you know, The Phantom Tollbooth.
Yeah.
And I read a lot of Encyclopedia Brown, you know,
yeah.
which you know, appealed to me at the time, even though in retrospect, he seems you know, really obnoxious.
Yeah, nosy.
Yeah, and he's a know-it-all, and he just is filled with arcane trivia. And I always wondered, you know, whenever I thought about reading those, what happened to him when he grew up?
Well, the internet made him obsolete, probably.
Well, yeah, exactly. Having a smartphone made him obsolete, but what would have happened to him is, you know, as he grew up and, you know, went to school and then lived on his own and, you know, fell in love with someone, you know.
Yeah.
But in middle school, so where I grew up, it was very literate. It was a very literate place, you know, surprisingly so in retrospect.
Yeah.
And we had to read a lot of things in middle school and high school that I don't think students in public school would read now. You know, I remember reading The Bear by Faulkner in middle school and The Lottery by Shirley Jackson.
Yeah, yeah.
We had to memorize El Dorado when I was in grammar school, when I was the Edgar Allan Poe poem.
Interesting.
And we did like a whole half a year on the epic Longfellow poem Evangeline by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow.
Yeah, yeah.
Which was terrible. It was just brutal. It's grueling to do that.
Yeah, it's torture.
And, you know, the Barbara Cummins novel I mentioned that I happened to read, the title comes from Longfellow.
Oh, okay.
It's who was changed and who was dead. It's a line from Longfellow. And we had to read, you know, that was middle school stuff.
That's very heady for middle school. I mean,
it was. Yeah. Something that happened to me in middle school that was really amazing was that in seventh grade, my English teacher showed us the Truffaut film Fahrenheit 451.
Oh, wow.
And we also read the book.
So you started to think about books and knowledge being like censored and banned.
Well, I thought about that because that's explicitly the subject of the, you know, the movie and the book.
Yeah, yeah.
But I more thought about how I loved the movie. It was like this huge eye-opening experience for me to see that film. And so I mostly thought about how much I liked the movie better than the book in a way. Mm-hmm. And how a movie could be that great. You know, I really liked movies a lot before that too, but I mostly liked, you know, 30s comedies, you know, things you'd see on TV. And I liked Westerns, you know, I like kind of Saturday afternoon type movies.
30s comedies are kind of an uncommon thing, I think, for a kid in middle school. Like what? Like It Happened One Night, that kind of thing?
No, well, not It Happened One Night, not anything that sophisticated, but like the Marx Brothers or W.C. Fields.
Got ya. Yeah.
Because those were just on television a lot back then.
Yeah, they were.
So seeing Fahrenheit 451 was really an eye-opening experience, you know? And later, when I moved to New York, you know, 20 years ago, I was an editor at the Book of the Month Club, briefly, which was not a great job, but it got me to New York out of Boston. I was desperate to leave Boston.
Yeah.
And one of the authors that we were working with was Ray Bradbury, and he was very old at the time. And they were bringing back a facsimile edition of Fahrenheit 451 for its anniversary.
Mm.
And so I had to deal with him. He wrote a new introduction, as I recall. And he was very nice. And I told him how I saw this in seventh grade and how important it was to me. And he sent me a book of his poems because he also writes poetry. Mm. And he wrote a note in it with an orange magic marker with an orange Sharpie. That was very nice. He wrote a note to me and he signed it. And then after the book finally came out, he sent me the same book again that he wrote a different note in, an orange magic marker too, because he had forgotten that he sent me the first one because he was like 92 years old or something.
That's funny.
Yeah. And so that movie was really important to me in the book too. And later in my life, when I was the film critic for N+1 and I was editing the N1FR, which is the N+1 film review that we did a couple of issues of,
right,
when I was still the film critic for N+1 and not the Baffler, Julie Christie read that somehow because she knows a writer who's written for N+1, who's, you know, older,
yeah,
named Pankaj Mishra. and he gave her a copy of it. And then she sent a note to me saying how much she liked it.
Wow.
And how much she liked my writing, just out of the blue. She sent it to N plus one. And the one of the editors there at the time did not know who she was.
Oh, no.
But he gave it to, you know, she's the star of Fahrenheit 451. Yeah. She plays two roles in it.
Yeah.
It's a double role, which is also kind of mind blowing when you're in seventh grade. One person could play two roles in the same film.
What an incredible piece of synchronicity that is.
Yeah, it was amazing. So that was a really important thing in my life in retrospect, you know, and I still love that film. I wrote something about it in a book, quite a while ago now, just a short thing. But
would you credit that film with getting you started on the kind of writer you became?
I think I would have to, yeah. And not just the film, but the combination of the novel and the film.
Right.
Like the experience of reading the book and seeing the film at the same time. Not even one after the other, but kind of.
What about that was it seeing how two different artists would approach the same material? Like, what about that was particularly compelling to you?
You know, it's hard to say what I was thinking in seventh grade about it, but what was compelling about it to me was I had never even thought about this kind of thing at all. You know, like I must have known in some vague way that there were films based on books.
Yeah.
That were adapted from books, you know, like I'd seen like a Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, right, with Bing Crosby.
Right, right.
Like I knew that was a Mark Twain book because I'd read that book when I was a kid. But it didn't matter to me that here was a film of that and here was the book. But in this case, they were kind of intertangled together, you know?
Yeah.
It just was this really amazing experience that was so eye-opening to me.
What a cool teacher that was to decide to show that to you kids.
I know. I don't think that a seventh grade English teacher would show that movie to kids now. They used to show us a lot of strange films back then. My Spanish teacher in high school showed us. He was a very right-wing guy. He'd been in the Mexican army. But he showed us Los Olvidados by Luis Buñuel. Los Olvidados was made in Mexico City. It was Buñuel's big comeback film in the early 50s.
What's it like? What's it about?
It's a film about juvenile delinquents and inner-city poverty that has a strange, surrealist touch. In which we, you know, see the dreams of the kids enacted, you know, depicted when they're asleep at night. And, you know, they kind of have, one of the kids kind of has incestuous longings. Mm. And, you know, it's a great film. It's a masterpiece. There's a scene that I remember so well, seeing it the first time when I was that age, of one of the kids throws an egg directly into the camera lens.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
But, you know, that's another film I don't think that would be shown to high school kids now. That was in high school, not in middle school.
No. It's interesting that it was a conservative sort of former military guy who decided to show you a Buñuel film.
I think it was just like the most famous or well-known film in Spanish that was a narrative feature that he could get, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think the actual content of the film was what was the most interesting thing to him. Although I remember he was sympathetic to the story of poverty.
After Fahrenheit 451, you know, when you're in seventh grade, I guess, you enter high school. Is high school when you start seeking out films that aren't, you know, easy to find?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, definitely. No question. Yeah.
And what was your route? How did you find them?
Well, I read a lot of books on films. You know, I started reading books about the cinema. But, you know, after the Fahrenheit 451, after that period in my life, I started reading a lot more seriously, you know. I mean, seeing movies really involved getting a driver's license.
Right.
You know, where I grew up. There's no movie theater in my town or the town next to it even, you know. My grandfather was a theologian.
Uh-huh.
And he was a professor and the president of a college called the Andover Newton Theological School in Newton, Massachusetts. And he was a minister at Newton Center, Massachusetts. So, you know, he was basically, you know, he was an intellectual. And he was also a Christian. And, you know, around that time, he introduced me to a lot of literature.
What do you remember?
Well, mainly Kafka.
Oh, wow. That's great.
Because he gave me the standalone hardcover copy of The Metamorphosis.
Yeah, wow.
And it had etchings in it. I can't remember the artist who did them now, but I was really fascinated by that book, and I would read it over and over again. And I would look at those drawings.
It's interesting that a devout Christian would be a Kafka fan to me.
Well, I feel that he was very interested in existentialism. He was kind of from a generation that, progressed from kind of Protestant theology through like Kierkegaardian philosophy.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And then to modernist literature. So, you know, he had a lot of really good books that I would read. And, you know, my mother had some good, weird books that I would read, too. She mostly read bestsellers.
Yeah.
But they had a copy of this book called Zeno's Conscience by Italo Svevo. They had this very strange cover of this green drawing of kind of almost a man who's like a stick figure, but not quite, against a black background. And he was smoking a cigarette. And I was really fascinated by the cover of that book. And it was a mass market paperback. It might have been even like an Anchor paperback or something. I don't know now. But I was really fascinated by the cover of that book. So when I was in high school, like early high school, I decided to read that book. And, you know, it's this great modernist classic. It's an Italian novel translated in English. And it was kind of a mind-blowing thing to read. It's about a guy trying to quit smoking in a way. But that's not all it's about. It's about his life. And, you know, it's kind of an existential novel also. And he kind of observes himself from the outside. And that book was really important to me at the time that I read it.
Is it it's Zeno as in like Zeno, the Stoic philosopher?
Yeah, it's spelled that way.
Okay.
Yeah, Zeno, Zeno's Conscience.
Did you talk with your grandfather and your mother about these books? Were there conversations about literature in your family?
No, I would talk to my grandfather about them, but not anybody else really.
Yeah.
But, you know, I talked to my grandmother once about the book Alive, you know, the book about the Chilean soccer players trapped in the Andes who had to resort to cannibalism.
Yes. Wow. That's a good topic for grandma.
That was like when I was in fourth grade.
Wow.
And my grandmother and I were watching TV and there was a talk show on and the survivors of the Alive disaster who were, you know, young soccer players from I guess they're from Chile. Yeah. Or maybe they were from Uruguay. I can't remember, but they were the guests on the show. And I had never thought about cannibalism or anything like that before in my life.
Sure. You're what? Eight years old.
And so I was just shocked by this concept that these guys had to do this. And I was watching with my grandmother and when it was over, I said, well, what if that happened to us? You know, and there was a plane crash and we were trapped somewhere like that. Would you eat my flesh to survive? And my grandmother said to me, well, you know, sometimes we have to do things we don't want to.
Wow.
In order to survive.
Wow.
And I that was not the answer that I expected.
The honesty is refreshing, though.
Yeah. So she was very blunt about it, you know?
Yeah.
And that really blew my mind. And then because of that, I sought out the paperback of that book.
At that age?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, because that book was everywhere back then.
I didn't know that. The movie only came out in the 90s, I think, right?
Yeah, but there was a Mexican film made of it in the 70s.
Oh, how was that?
I don't really I saw it eventually, but I don't really remember it very well. But the book was like a huge, huge bestseller. You would just see that. It had a blue cover with the snowy mountains on it. And just the word Alive on top.
Kind of compelling.
Yeah, you would see that book everywhere back then, you know, for years.
What kind of a reader was your father?
My father did not read at all.
Oh.
He doesn't read now. He's still alive. He doesn't read. He's not interested in that in the least.
What does he do for a living? Or what did he do for a living?
Well, he still does it. He owns a carpet store, floor covering establishment. Yeah.
Gotcha.
And he would maybe read like one. He used to take my sister and me to an amusement park in Agawam, Massachusetts, called Riverside Amusement Park.
Uh-huh.
And instead of taking us on all the rides and things himself, he would just, you know, buy us a bunch of tickets and let us do whatever we wanted. And he would buy one book a year so he could sit on a bench and read this book while we were at Riverside Amusement Park.
That's kind of incredible.
Yeah, and it would always be a sports biography.
Right. Like the bio of Bear Bryant or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Or Yogi Berra, more likely.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Baseball or golfer. It was either baseball or golf.
Wow.
Yeah. And, or sometimes maybe it would be a book by Dan Rather.
Oh God.
Or like a memoir or biography or something of Dan Rather, Dan Rather, something like that, you know, but that would be the only book he read, you know, all year.
I had this really weird moment of synchronicity involving you actually yesterday. It was very strange. I was preparing for this interview, but then also I had gotten nostalgic for this magazine from the 90s, late 90s, early 2000s called Hermonaut.
Yeah.
And I ordered a copy on eBay, just a random copy that I found.
Wow.
And I got it yesterday. And as I'm thinking about you, I opened this copy from 1999 and it opens to your review of Ray Manzarek's memoir, Ray Manzarek from the Doors. And it was a great piece of polemic writing.
Oh, thank you. It's called that piece is. I think Manzarek's autobiography was called "Light My Fire."
Yeah,
is that
that's
right?
Right. It was. Yeah.
My piece was called "Lights, Camera, Organ."
Right. Organ functioning in two different ways, both for Jim Morrison's Dick and for Ray Manzarek. Yeah. Yeah. And then you also have a great review of a Roberto Rossellini bio in there too. So I just thought that was nice to stumble across that.
Well, that's really amazing. I was the co-editor of Hermonaut. It was a zine that we did in Boston for about 10 years. And, you know, I wrote pieces in each issue, and I wrote some pieces under a pseudonym that was supposed to be like Ed Anger's column in the Weekly World News.
Oh, nice.
And the Ray Manzarek review actually got me a job at Suck.com.
Oh, I remember Suck. Wow.
Yes, I the editor of Suck hired me to write a piece about the film American Beauty.
Uh-huh.
Because he had read that Ray Manzarek review.
That's funny.
In Hermonaut. Yeah.
Can you, for people who don't, Hermonaut was really great, but I feel like it's kind of drifted into the clouds of obscurity a little bit. Can you sort of talk about it a little bit?
The editor and publisher of the magazine just made up that word that combines hermeneutics and astronaut.
Okay, got it. What was the mission sort of Hermonaut?
Well, Hermonaut was a zine that was kind of, you know, it was supposed to be about popular culture and philosophy, both. And it started, well, the guy who edited it did a couple of issues before I came on, and a bunch of friends of mine came on. And in the early years of it, we would always put on the cover an actor from Beverly Hills 90210, because we would all get together once a week and watch that show, then Melrose Place when they were on.
Oh, the good old days.
Yeah, and we used to, you know, when the pages came back from Kinko's, you know, copy, where we were getting them done for free, you know, a lot of the time, we would have a big saddle stapler, and we would staple all the issues together while we were watching those shows on the floor of my apartment that I lived in with my girlfriend at the time, who was the art director.
That's great.
Of the but then, you know, we stopped doing that around 2000.
It developed also to something that wasn't a stapled zine. It got quite well produced.
Yeah, it was perfect bound the last few issues, and you know, it was like over 200 pages, and you know, it was sold all over the world. People read that in London and Mexico City, Tokyo, you know, all over the place. It sold quite well for a while, but then the whole bottom fell out of everything during the .com collapse. A lot of distributors went out of business, and you know, just crumbled.
I think there's a place, there's this thing that happens in culture where people in their 20s start to discover continental philosophy and kind of link it to style, and they're sort of stylish readers of Foucault. You know what I mean? And this kind of comes and goes in culture. That moment it's back again right now, and I think Hermonaut is ripe for rediscovery by people like that.
Well, it may well be. That certainly was the genesis of Hermonaut, that being that kind of person that, you know, has discovered all this critical theory,
right?
You know,
right.
And wants to apply it to everything, you know, that you see in popular culture.
Yeah.
So it was ahead of its time in that sense. I mean, there weren't a lot of other things like that then.
So just thinking of zines, fanzines, what do you remember in high school? Were you reading zines at all or creating zines?
When I was in sixth grade, I did a Star Trek zine.
That's cool.
With some friends of mine, yeah. We did like five issues. It was about, you know, classic Star Trek with William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy, because those were always on after school.
Right.
You know, you would get home, turn on the TV, and it was, you know, syndicated reruns of Star Trek.
So what kind of stuff did you put in the zine?
Just reviews of the episodes and things like that. It was not impressive.
That's incredible, though. What, do you remember the title of it?
I do not. And when my mother sold the house I grew up in, she just threw all that stuff away.
Oh, that's too bad.
So
that's the kind of thing that you find at an estate sale and you're like, I have no idea what this is, but I have to have it.
Yeah. I mean, I don't even know if it'd be that interesting. But so that in the 90s I did Hermonaut, and then I got I started contributing a lot to Suck.com.
Yeah, can you tell our listeners what Suck.com was? Just the 101 on that.
Suck.com was the website that basically invented the form of how writing appears on the internet, which is a long stream of prose in the middle of the page with gutters on the left and right side.
Yeah.
But more than that, it was a cultural criticism site that started to mock people in the tech world.
Hmm.
That branched out into being this kind of satire and site about, you know, everything in American culture. So like I said, the first piece I wrote for them was about the film American Beauty, and it was a piece called Shamesploitation.
Nice.
So I wrote a lot of stuff about films for them, but I also wrote other things too. And, you know, that was the late 90s, and it was internet writing, and it paid like a dollar a word.
Yeah.
You could write two pieces for them, and you would have rent and everything that you needed for the month, pretty much. Suck was owned by the two guys that started it. And, you know, Suck's, their mantra was sell early and often. So it went through the hands of various owners, but it started out when they were both working at Wired.
Okay.
And they were very, very smart guys named Carl Stedman and Joey Anoff. Oh, I have a funny story about the Manzarek book review that I wrote.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, that was only in a zine, so it was only in print, right?
Yeah.
And it might have been on, Hermonaut had a .com for a while, but I don't know if that was ever on it. I can't remember now. It must have been at some point. But then that was just all gone, that stuff. But the drummer in the Doors had a website.
Huh.
And I can't remember his name. What, do you know the name of the drummer in the Doors?
Robbie Krieger was the guitar player.
So then it was John Densmore.
That's right.
And he had a website, and I guess he did not like Ray Manzarek very much. So he took the entire review. It's a long piece. It's like 3,000 word piece,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
He took the entire review and he put it on his website. And his website was just about being the drummer in the Doors. But it also had this long review I'd written of Ray Manzarek's autobiography in a zine on his website. And I don't think it's there anymore, but it was there for some time.
That's really funny, because that review is absolutely scathing regarding Manzarek.
Well, you know, there's my friend Glenn Jones told me to read that book. He was the guitarist in a band called Cul-de-Sac.
Oh, I remember them.
And he's just a solo guitarist now. He puts out a lot of solo guitar records in the American primitive style, you know, like John Fahey.
Yeah, yeah.
And me and the bass player in Cul-de-Sac, who was the film critic Chris Fujiwara, we used to make films that were shown when Cul-de-Sac was playing. So Glenn happened to read the Ray Manzarek autobiography. He's like, you know, you really should write about this because there's a lot of film content in it.
Yeah.
Because Jim Morrison and Ray Manzarek were film students together at UCLA.
Right, right.
And their professor was Joseph von Sternberg.
We should just footnote von Sternberg. I mean,
Joseph von Sternberg was one of the greatest directors in the history of cinema. But he directed a bunch of films with Marlene Dietrich in the early 30s.
Yeah.
Starting with The Blue Angel and ending with The Scarlet Empress.
Such good movies. And he taught The Doors.
Yeah, and he taught The Doors. These things that you do essentially for free, you know, like, you know, I mean, I got paid a tiny bit of money to write that. It's funny how they have these afterlives, you know?
Yeah, they pop back up.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that the drummer in The Doors liked that piece was very, you know, it was amazing. It's kind of mind blowing, because when I was a little kid, the piece talks about this. I thought the Doors were like music for little kids.
Right, right, right. Like circus music or something.
Yeah, because of the song Riders on the Storm.
Oh, with all the sound effects. It's like a little like story for children.
Well, it has the organ that Raymond Zarek plays is like rain, kind of.
Yeah.
And there's like thunderstorm sound effects. And even though it's a really creepy song, I didn't, as a little child, I didn't understand nearly what it was. I just thought it was kids' music. I don't know why I thought that.
Well, I think you were right. It is kids' music, ultimately.
I mean, I used to hate the Doors, kind of, but now I really like the album L.A. Woman.
I still struggle with the Doors. I haven't never been able to break through. No pun intended.
I mean, break it to the other side. Yeah. I mean,
it always troubled me how Ray Manzarek produced the album X, the album Los Angeles by X.
Yeah, their first two albums, I think.
Both of them, yeah. And then he put his little organ touches on there that always kind of like took me out of it a little bit.
Yeah, and they covered a Doors song on their first record.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. So, anyway, the Doors kind of sound better now than I thought when I was younger.
I kind of like wanted to ask you about, the lineage that you're in of film critics, and what you think of the sort of titans of that world. So, what do you think of Pauline Kael?
Well, the reason I was reading that Menan book was to read his stuff on Pauline Kael. When I was a kid, like in middle school and high school, I read Pauline Kael every week in the New Yorker.
Yeah.
I just took that for granted. That was just something you did because my mother subscribed to the New Yorker. But, you know, as I became, more sophisticated in the kind of undergrad way about movies, I rejected Pauline Kael and I came to hate her.
Yeah.
And I was totally on the side of Andrew Saris in that great debate that lingers somehow.
Yeah.
But, as I've gotten older, as with the Doors, I really like Pauline Kael now. And I think that the way that she's been ganged up on by critics who aren't her acolytes, by auteurist critics through the decades, I think is really terrible. And I also think it's very sexist. And I also think the generation of women writers that came after her were very mean to her, like Susan Sontag and Joan Didion.
Yeah.
And obviously, Renata Adler, famously.
Well, her screed against Pauline Kael is devastating. Yeah.
And I also love Renata Adler as a film critic. I think she's great.
She's great. You know? She is there. I have that. There's a collection, A Year in the Dark, of all her criticism.
I love that book.
Me too.
So now I'm a fan of Pauline Kael, and I think Menan's Kael is really, he really doesn't understand what's important about Pauline Kael, but he thinks he does, and he has this whole theory about her, and, it's really reductivist, whatever the right word is, and it's kind of offensive, and it's very glib. And also, in that book, his new book, all he did was recycle his essay on Pauline Kael from the 1990s. And so much has changed in the reception of cinema since he wrote that.
Yeah, definitely.
He is not up to date at all. So he basically says that films like Blowout by Brian De Palma and Monsieur Verdoux by Chaplin, he's like, these are worthless films that people don't care about anymore.
No. Blowout. I mean, just Blowout alone is very fetishized by like young hip people now.
Well, obviously, that's very true. De Palma in general, but that is not a world that Louis Menand knows anything about.
Of course not. So, what is important about Pauline Kael? What do you like about how she approaches writing about film?
Well, in retrospect, she's wrong about a lot of things. She's wrong about John Cassavetes. She's wrong about Claude Chabrol. She's wrong about lots of stuff. But what's important about Kael in retrospect is that she did that, 6 months a year, every week. She watched all these films. They gave her a lot of space to write about them.
Yeah.
And one thing that's true that Menan points out is that later in her career, they were giving her too much space. She needed to be edited more.
Yeah.
But in the late 60s and throughout the 70s, the amount of space that they gave her was incredible. So she was really able to write, thoroughly.
Expansively.
About all the stuff that was coming out. I mean, she would have 9 pages sometimes in the New Yorker.
It's incredible.
And there's nothing like that now. So to read, a period, and especially American cinema, covered so comprehensively by one critic who's, a great writer. I mean, you may you know, quibble with her style or her taste. But, you know, it's really great. There's nothing like it now. There's nothing like that going on now, you know? So when I started writing for N+1, you know, I was already the product of a world that was after that, which is the consumer guide approach to film criticism, you know?
Recap versus review.
Well, the word recap didn't even exist yet when I started writing for N+1.
Okay.
You know, it's 2008. There was no television recap really.
Yeah.
But, you know, after many years of trying to, you know, write the way I wanted to and being thwarted by newspaper and magazine editors, you know, largely, and coming from zines where you could do whatever you want, wanted to do.
Yeah.
You know, N+1 gave me the opportunity to do that. But at the same time, I had a full-time job, so it was hard for me to write as much as they wanted me to, or as much as I wanted to write for them.
Yeah.
So I tried to develop a style that was concise, you know? And that, as I say in the introduction to my book, that threw out all these things that I didn't like when I read film criticism.
Yeah, I really like that you sort of set a mission for yourself to avoid using anything that could be appropriated for publicity, for posters or quotes.
I definitely try to do that still. I don't like anything I write being excerpted for posters or, or, you know, the DVD box or whatever.
But these editors before N+1, these newspaper and magazine editors who were cutting you down, were they cutting only for length or were there other things that they were kind of always going against?
It wasn't you know, writing for Hermanot was great. Writing for zines was great. Writing for Suck.com was great. My editor at Suck.com was a great guy who was really smart. And he made everything better just like by like breathing on it.
Right.
But then when I got hired to write for magazines or newspapers, it was totally different. I mean, they just wanted everything to sound like it was written by paper. It was not adventurous. It wasn't witty. It was just bland. You know, it was bland and, you know, they didn't want you to express any kind of personality or character. You couldn't have opinions that they would consider outré. You know, it was difficult. It was a whole different world and it was hard to adjust to that.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and of course, you know, the early 2000s or so, you know, early to, you know, up through like 2007, you know, it was really hard to do what they wanted, you know.
Because what you were writing about, you had different things to say than that they wanted to hear.
Yeah. And it was also boring and it didn't pay well. So it just seemed loserish to me.
Yeah.
To try to do that kind of thing.
I think more writers would benefit from sort of doing their work in fanzines first.
Well, they don't really exist like they used to exist.
No, you know? They don't, which is a shame. Although there's this kind of explosion of this Substack newsletter world now that feels a little bit zine-ish to me sometimes.
See, I don't think it is, actually, because Substack promotes very, very long pieces that are unedited.
Mm.
And a lot of it is just babble, in a way. So if you were writing for a zine in the 90s, you know, it could only be so many pages because it costs money.
Yeah, yeah.
Even though it wasn't a lot of money, you know, or maybe your friend Xeroxed it for you or something. You didn't want to be, you know, pieces in Hermanot are quite long, but they're also concise and they're well edited for the most part.
Yeah,
and,
they are.
You know, it wasn't the same as being online, you know. You know, the blog, the existence of blogs changed the way that people approach writing earlier in their careers, or it did back then.
Yes.
You know, in the late 90s and early 2000s. Because in blogs, people would just go on and on and on into the night.
I think it also made everybody feel like they were qualified to be a memoirist, no matter their age or experience.
Well, that's true, yeah. It made everybody think that they were interesting.
Right.
Because it was just about self-expression, so it didn't really matter so much if anybody was reading it. And for the most part, it wasn't polemical anymore either. So, you know, zines were more, you know, there was an angry quality to them that blogs did not have. Blogs were more, the fan part became more prominent in a way, again.
There's a book that I want to read, and I want to know if you think it's any good, and it's Transcendental Style in Film by Paul Schrader.
Worth reading, sure, absolutely.
What's it about? Like, what does it cover?
It's about you know, primarily three directors that he finds exemplify this aesthetic style that he's invented in his mind. And they are Robert Bresson, Carl Dreyer, and Yasujirō Ozu.
Okay.
And, you know, I think that, as with many things Schrader, a lot of people find that dated now.
Yeah.
They find his whole approach dated, and it's certainly out of style in a way. But that book is very much worth reading. And I read that when I was in high school, so it introduced me to those directors.
Mm.
There's also a section on Bud Bedeker at the end of the book, the director of Randolph Scott Westerns. So, you know, that book introduced me to the work of those filmmakers who are all directors that I really love. And so I'm glad that he wrote that book. And it just came, you know, that book came back into print when my book came out.
Oh, cool.
I did an event at Metrograph, the movie theater in Lower Manhattan.
Yeah.
And then the person who was doing an event after me was Paul Schrader.
Did you meet him?
No, I didn't. But I was having dinner with my friend Anne Elizabeth Moore, who had interviewed me for the Chicago Reader that day about my book, and with Julie Doucet, the cartoonist.
Oh, I love her work.
Yeah, and we were eating, and you know, then we were having like a drink after dinner or something, and the waitress came over and said, "You guys have to leave now because Paul Schrader's party needs this table." and I said, "But I did an event here this afternoon," and the waitress said, "Yeah, that was this afternoon."
Wow, wow, that's really funny. Yeah.
Yeah.
What does he mean by transcendental in this context?
He means that they have a spiritual quality that transcends normal considerations of what are the kinds of things that should be in a movie and what can a movie do.
I see.
And that these films are able to, through the personal style of those directors, put this soul state on the screen.
Yeah.
So there's an anti-material aspect to it that, you know, seems very un-Bressonian in a way now. I'm not really an expert on that book. I haven't read it really. I haven't read it since probably like early college. But you know, at the time when I first read it, it was an important book to me. And I like Paul Schrader's films. I mean, you know,
yeah.
I love the last one with Ethan Hawke.
Yeah. I was rereading your collection, your reviews collection. And I read that review of First Reformed, Schrader's last film.
Right.
And you mentioned the book in there. So it reminded me that I've always meant to check that out.
Paul Schrader had a really weird letter he wrote to Harper's a couple of months ago.
What was it about?
It was criticizing Martin Scorsese for liking movies too much.
What? Okay.
And Paul, and he was saying, you know, I go home to Michigan or wherever he's from, and, you know, all my relatives, you know, they just watch Netflix. They don't even go to the movies anymore.
Uh-huh.
I'm like, well, Paul, you know, there is a pandemic going on.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, I don't know where they live, but a lot of movie theaters closed even before that. And, you know, if you ask my relatives about their cinema going habits, you know, it would be pretty hair raising. Okay. You know, these people are not going to, you know, movies like Paul Schrader did when he was a kid, but he wasn't the average film goer when he was, when he first saw movies
no,
when he was 18.
Of course not.
You know, and he's acting like something's been lost because, you know, I don't know. It was a dumb letter.
What did Scorsese said that triggered this?
He had written a piece in Harper's about how film going was in the 60s
uh-huh.
when he was younger. He was in college, and how it was essentially a piece about seeing Fellini films as they came out.
Okay.
It was a piece on Fellini.
Uh-huh.
But Schrader wrote this letter. You know, I think there's some kind of residual buried animosity. You know, who knows? It was very strange. But more than strange, it was dumb.
Yeah, yeah. But First Reformed is so good, the last movie he made.
Yes, it was. He's got another one coming out, I guess.
Do you know anything about it?
I think it's about gambling.
Hmm.
I don't really know that much about it, but, you know, he and I are friends on Facebook until he hears this, I guess.
I'm sure he's listening. What's the typical process like for you to write a review? Like, what kind of a note taker are you? What kind of a, like, how many drafts do you go through?
Oh, I take a lot of notes, you know. I just write everything down.
While you're watching it?
Well, if I'm in a movie theater while I'm watching it, yeah. But if I'm doing it at home, I'll pause it sometimes to take notes. You know, and when I start writing it, the columns that are reviews of many films at once, you know.
Yeah.
I each section. It's a different film, or usually, or maybe a group of films.
Right.
Or it could be a book. It could be something that happened to me. It could be a lot of things. But let's say it's a review of just one film that ends up being like, you know, a 300 to 500 or 600 word part of that piece. When I write it, I write way more than that, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, so much more. And then I just start cutting everything that I don't like until it's really reduced, you know, to the point where I don't think I can cut anything else out. You know, and then I give it to my editors and they find stuff to cut out, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's really a process of kind of boiling it down.
I think that's one of the most effective processes of writing is just to really, really have too much and overwrite, and then the work happens in the revision.
Right, but I don't. When I send it to my editors, I don't send them stuff that's too much.
No, I'm
or
saying
overwritten.
You do that yourself. Yeah, you do that. Yeah.
I do that myself.
That's what I mean. Yeah, I mean, yeah.
So that's kind of how that goes. If it's a longer piece or just, you know, a long piece about one film, it's kind of different.
Yeah. What triggered the move to The Baffler from N Plus One?
Oh, they offered me more money. Yeah,
there you go.
I mean, I love The Baffler. I've written for The Baffler a lot before that. You know, there's pieces in my book that were in The Baffler when I was the critic for N Plus One.
Right, right, right.
There's a long piece about zombie movies that was in The Baffler, and you know, I've known the Baffler guys since the '90s.
With Thomas Frank,
you know, yeah, and then the editor in chief of The Baffler now, Jonathan Sturgeon, used to work with me on the N1FR, the film review.
Oh,
supplement.
Cool. Okay.
Yeah. So, but, you know, Tom Frank, Chris Lehman, Dave Mulcahy, I mean, a lot of those guys don't really have anything to do with Baffler anymore. But I knew them back in the day, no?
Yeah, yeah. That's another one, like Hermanot, that is ripe for deeper rediscovery by younger people right now.
Well, the Baffler, you know, you can get back issues of the Baffler directly from the Baffler. And, you know, there's been like 2 or 3 volumes of stuff from the Baffler published in book form, too. And those books are still in print, you know, and the Baffler is still going. It's a going concern. They have a lot of subscribers.
I really liked how they were able to mix literature with critical essays.
Yes. Yeah. Which they still do.
Yeah.
They have their literary editor is a guy named J.W. McCormick now, who's great. And he used to write for the N1FR too. He wrote like this 10,000 word piece on a Raul Ruiz film on Treasure Island.
Wow.
Yeah. I think that piece is called The Black Spot, and it's online. Anybody wants to read it. It's at N Plus One still.
What happened to the N Plus One film review? That's discontinued, right?
Yeah. I mean, when I was doing that, I had a full-time job still, and it was very hard to get it out. The first one came together pretty easily, and it was sponsored by advertising by IFC.
Wow, that's great.
Then the second one took a lot longer because I was working more and more in my job. It was taking more and more time, and I had to travel more and more for my job.
Was this the job where you were using semiotics to analyze television for brand consultancies?
Yes, I was a semiotic brand analyst for the television industry. I didn't do it for brand consultancies. I worked for a brand consultancy.
I see.
And we did it for broadcast television and cable television networks.
So tell me, like, what's a typical project in that job?
You know, the point of that kind of research and, you know, the reports we would make and the presentations we would do was to help networks design shows that would attract more viewers.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of research is not really done so much anymore. The algorithms replaced that. And so did kind of like, you know, epistemological standpoint analysis, which
right,
is
right.
Really like diversity consulting.
Yeah.
So what we did was just pure, it was cultural analysis, and you know, it encompassed all these other things too. But I'm very glad I don't do that anymore. I don't like to watch television anymore. I watched every television show that was on for 8 years in a row.
My God.
I watched hundreds and hundreds of reality television series, you know. When I say that, I mean like whole seasons of these things.
Jesus.
You know, I had to watch like, you know, every season of Big Bang Theory.
Oh, no.
I had to watch, you know, a lot of quality, so-called quality drama.
Right.
And, you know, I'm off TV now. I was, you know, meeting with television executives all the time, watching the shows, dealing with, you know, how television is marketed and create, you know, I just am not interested in it at all. And I don't think it's very good.
I think it's overrated for sure, especially the prestige drama world.
Well, you know, we're kind of past that point in the history of television now.
Yeah.
The streaming years have, you know, washed that away to some extent.
Yeah, yeah.
Because one aspect of those kind of shows was that the people that were making them, you know, were left alone by the people who were producing.
They were like
them.
Television auteurs.
Yeah. And, you know, that's not really, I don't see that happening as much anymore. Although everyone loves the show White Lotus that's on now. You know?
Yeah, so, yeah.
I don't know. I'm not going to watch it because I don't watch this stuff anymore. So occasionally I will watch things that are kind of in the area between the cinema and television.
Such as?
You know? Well, I watched Underground Railroad and I watched, you know, the Steve McQueen movies.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, my mind is going. I can't remember the overarching title of those.
They're called them now. Me either. But the Lover's Rock was really great.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So I watched those and trying to think of what else. You know, when there are things that are in that area that's between the two, I'll watch them. Especially if they're made by, you know, if the whole run of the show is made by one director.
Yeah.
Like Barry Jenkins. If he does the whole thing, you know, it's you know, worth watching.
Do you write about these or do you only write about film?
No, I would write. Well, a lot of the stuff. So I wrote a lot during the pandemic. I wrote like 27 pieces in the first 15 months of the pandemic.
Wow.
And then I kind of hit a wall, you know, at the beginning of the summer or at the end of May. And I've had a lot of trouble writing over the summer. So, like, that came out during that period, so I didn't write about it. But if I were doing a column, I would have included it, you know?
Yeah.
But, I, you know, in the fall, I plan to get back to a regular schedule of writing, but I was really burned out, you know? Just being at home for that many months alone, I watched, like, 700 movies.
Jesus.
You know, and I just wrote and wrote. I did a lot of podcasts and stuff too. You know, I did other things.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it was very, you know, it was really wearing, you know. When I started, like in high school, reading film critics from the past and reading stuff about film, it all seemed very obscure. You know, primarily because there weren't many people to talk about it with. You know, I lived in a small town and maybe I knew one or two other people that were interested in movies, but not a lot of people. It was not community, you know, but there was a book that I read that I wish would come back into print that I love. That's called Film and Anthology.
Film and Anthology. And
Film, colon, and Anthology.
Got it.
And it was edited by Dan Talbot. Who was a very important person in film distribution and film curation, I guess they would call it now, in New York in the 60s. And this book was just so eye-opening to me. It had pieces. I actually have it on the shelf behind me where I'm sitting, the copy that I've had all this time. I got it at a used bookstore. But it had pieces by Cale and Parker Tyler and John Grierson, the British documentary theoretician.
Yeah.
Had James Agee and Robert Warshaw and Manny Farber.
Oh, cool.
Gilbert Seldes, who's so great, you know.
I don't know him. I don't know Gilbert.
He was an American essayist and critic, and mostly in the 20s. He wrote a book called, what is it called? It's so good. It's a great, great book. NYRB Classics brought it back into print.
Okay.
Several years ago. But this book, Film and Anthology, also had a section on film theory. And it had pieces by Bela, Balazs, and Pudovkin in it, and Cocteau. And then it had, like, a section of, like, historical memoirs, and one of which is by Ben Hecht.
Oh, cool. He comes back up now. Yeah, yeah.
And it also had Siegfried Krakauer and stuff in it. And this book was, like, a really eye-opening book to me at the time. And I wish that book would come back into print.
Are there any books by directors that you particularly like?
Well, a lot of books by directors aren't very good, but yeah. My Last Side by Luis Buñuel is great, masterpiece.
I haven't read that.
And it's really incredible. And it's in English, but the whole book has not been translated into English, as I understand it. It's still in print in English. It's really amazing.
Is it a memoir?
It's a memoir, but it's also about his film career and filmmaking in general and his ideas on screenwriting. And, you know, Jean-Claude Carrière helped him write it, his screenwriter for his last several films.
Yeah.
That book is really great. Jean Renoir's My Life and My Films is really, really great. Okay. That, I don't know if that's in print now, but it should be. Joseph von Sternberg wrote an autobiography called Fun in a Chinese Laundry. That is great and should be in print. I don't know if that's still in print. It's called Fun in a Chinese Laundry because he used to be like a guy. Well, his first job in movies was cleaning movies.
Oh,
he would clean the prints.
Yeah, yeah.
And he had a lot of, you know, he's a great thinker through the medium of film and through lighting, and you know, he's an artist. He's, you know, a great artist. You know, for him, film was, you know, an art like anything else.
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
But when he was doing that job when he was younger, all the films were just these stupid movies that he had contempt for, that he thought were idiotic.
Right.
You know, and the one that he remembered most for some reason is called Fun in a Chinese Laundry. And, you know, and he thought like the whole concept of that was stupid. It's not fun to work in a laundry. It was insulting to Chinese people. And it was just, he just had contempt for this.
Yeah.
And so he named his book that. That's a very good book. And, you know, when I was young, I loved John Waters' Shock Value.
Oh, sure. Yeah, that is good.
When I was in high school, that book was like really amazing to me. A real eye-opening book. And, you know, whenever John Waters' movie was playing, you know, my friends and I would drive to New Haven or Stamford, Connecticut, or, you know, wherever it was playing to go see them at midnight on the weekends.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
That book is really great. I'm sure that's in print.
It is, yeah. And I think for its time, it was like, I think kind of like what you're saying, it was very valuable because it told you about other things to go find.
Yes, it did. Like, you know, William Castle and Russ Meyer.
Yeah, right, right.
Herschel Gordon Lewis, especially for me.
Oh, you're a big fan?
I mean, I've become more and more of a fan over the years, but that was the first place I heard of him, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
Those are great books by directors. There's not a lot of other ones that are great, I don't think.
I wonder if there's anything more contemporary. There are things that are sort of great because they're bad. Like I read William Friedkin's memoir. And
I haven't read that, you know.
It's completely unhinged.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
You know, it would be unhinged. I mean, everyone loves Sidney Lumet's book about filmmaking, but I've never read that. I really should read it.
Yeah, I haven't either. What about books by actors? Because talking about Friedkin and unhingedness reminded me of Kinski Uncut, which is one of the craziest, you know, memoirs ever.
Well, I did. I mean, I read that at the time. I don't need to read that again. I mean, there's a book by George Sanders that I really liked.
Oh, cool. I love him. What's
I can't remember it now. There's also a memoir of Sanders by the actor Brian Ahern that's very entertaining called, I think it's called A Terrible Man. I don't think that's the exact title, but it's something like that. That's a very entertaining book to read.
Sanders had one of the best suicide notes ever.
Yeah, see, he's well known for his suicide. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
You know, books by actors are not usually that good.
No.
There's a new book by Andrew McCarthy out that I wanted to write about. I haven't read it yet.
The sort of Brat Pack actor?
The Brat Pack actor. He's got a memoir out called, I think it's called Brat. I just got a review copy of it.
That's kind of interesting to me, actually.
You know, I'll see how it is.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
The Gilbert Selvies book that I was talking about is called The Stammering Century.
Okay.
That's a great book.
What does he talk about in it?
He talks about kind of like, it's a book about the 19th century, really, about America's cultural past. And he talks about all different kinds of entertainment that were going on then. And it's just so beautifully written, and it's just great. And, you know, he was a film critic, too, you know?
Yeah.
I think he was one of the first Americans to, like, write seriously about silent cinema and Chaplin. And
yeah.
So
and in the book, is he talking about, like, vaudeville and theater, things like that?
Yeah, he talks about that. You know, again, it's been such a long time since I read that.
Sure, sure.
But, you know, that was kind of a formative book for me when I first read it.
We talked a little bit about Fahrenheit 451 and adaptations. I was thinking about, there's a movie in your collection called Zama that you liked a lot. That was also an adaptation, which I actually just went...
Oh, Zama, yeah.
Yeah, the Argentine film. I went out and rented that last night because of your recommendation. And I'm just wondering... What are some adaptations from books that you feel were unsuccessful?
Oh my God. That's,
yeah. Just what comes to mind first.
Well, Zama is a great movie.
I'm looking forward to that. Yeah, it looks great.
Yeah. Lucrezia Martel directed that. And it has a very strange mood. You know, it's a film about colonialism, but it's about a lot more than that. You know,
it seems it drifts into kind of Aguirre, Wrath of God kind of territory.
It does. Yeah. But it's based on a novel that was, I think, written in the 50s.
Right.
I read the novel, Antonio de Benedetto.
How is it?
And it's an excellent short novel, you know, I saw the film before I read the novel. So she really captures the mood of that novel in a unique, strange way.
Yeah.
That kind of goes beyond the book, somehow.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's a book that's great to read and see the film too.
And for listeners, I just want to reiterate that I always put notes on the website with all these things listed, but we're talking about a film and a book called Zama, Z-A-M-A.
Yes, Zama. But you know, when you ask, it's more, you know, so many books are adapted for the screen that just don't work on the screen.
Yeah.
You know, that the director who made them doesn't really get it, you know? And for instance, I love the book Crash by J.G. Ballard.
Yes. Uh-huh.
You know, I used to be a movie theater projectionist for 7 years.
Oh, wow.
And one thing that I would do when this was in the 90s. So I was the shifts were between like 7 and 13 hours. So when you're not making up the film or breaking it down or checking the focus or doing a changeover or cleaning some machinery or something, I would just read the complete works of some writer.
Yeah.
And of course, this is before smartphones. So now projectionists may not do this, but I was just in the booth. I didn't have anything else to do except attend to the films. So one person I read their complete works was J.G. Ballard,
right.
You know, as much as I could get my hands on,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
So I read Crash I didn't really like the Cronenberg film.
I didn't either. I actually, strangely enough, that was a movie that I decided I needed to rewatch like a couple months ago. And I rented it. A Criterion edition just came out, but I rented an older version. And I didn't like it. What don't you like about it?
Well, I think if you haven't read the book, you probably really love the film because it's so just the idea of what it's about is so strange. And the story is so strange.
Yeah.
And I think that James Spader is a good person to play the main character.
I do. And I think Elias Koteas was good casting also.
I thought he was terrible.
Oh, wow. Okay.
He was totally miscast in that film in every way.
What do you think that character should have been like?
That character should have been like somebody much slicker in kind of a 70s way.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I like that he was sort of ugly, but still sexy.
No, I thought that he was doing like a De Niro performance. It didn't work for me at all.
Okay.
But the thing that didn't work the most is that I think the novel is very dependent on taking place in London and in the outer rings of the London, you know, highway system, whatever that's called.
Yeah.
But you recall in the book, it's Elizabeth Taylor, who's the star that's kind of in town to make a movie.
Right.
And, you know, he keeps seeing her on the road and she's in, you know, there's all these stories about her everywhere. It needed to have like an Elizabeth Taylor part in it.
Yes, you're right.
Even if you didn't make the star Elizabeth Taylor, because, you know, you can't really get Elizabeth Taylor, you have to find the equivalent of that because it was set in the present.
Yeah. There was nothing like that. Nothing like that at all.
There was nothing like that. Yeah. So, but again, if you haven't read the book, the film probably seems way more interesting than someone who has read the book. And I love Cronenberg, you know.
Me too.
It's more interesting to talk about, I think, in a way, adaptations that are better than the books.
Such as?
Well, I think that The Grapes of Wrath and Breakfast at Tiffany's are better than the books.
Yeah. Breakfast at Tiffany's for sure.
You know, there's a whole piece on The Grapes of Wrath in my book.
Right.
It's always better when the movie kind of transcends the literature, you know. Not in the Schrader way of transcendence.
Yeah.
But that it's like it adds something that goes beyond the book, you know, it's more moving or more emotional or more painful,
right,
or something.
Sure.
Yeah. Or funnier even. So, I mean, you can name all sorts of films that are not as good as the books. That's like very common.
It's,
you know, so many non-superhero movies now are all based on novels or, you know, there's too much based on a book stuff now.
I know. I mean, the film rights to books are bought the day the deal is made to actually publish the book in general.
Yes. Some books are, you know, they pretend that the book existed before the film, but the book was actually written, so it could be a film.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, this is a thing that happens in publishing now.
I didn't know this. Do you know an example of it?
I do know some, but I don't know if I want to talk about that.
Oh, wow. We found something. We found something you can't talk about. That's interesting.
I mean, I just don't know quite enough about it to talk about, but I do know a couple of things where this, you know, the book was written to be filmed so it could be sold. But, you know, it was, you know, the producers got someone to write a book.
So the producers might have had a setting and a concept and gone to a novelist and said, write this book. And
yeah, wow. Yes. Or a team of people who act as one novelist.
Wow.
You know, I think we should return to original screenplays.
I do, too. It's been too long. What is it that qualifies a critic to be a critic?
What qualifies a critic to be a critic?
Yeah.
I mean, there's no set criteria for that. So it could be it's different things for different people. But, you know, the main things are that you can write, you know, you have a voice. That's the most important thing. Your knowledge of the history of cinema is probably the second most important thing.
Yeah.
And then, you know, seeing lots and lots and lots of films is very important. And then having a distance position from fandom is also important.
Oh, that's interesting. What do you mean by that?
Well, I feel a lot of criticism today is too, you know, everybody's standing.
Yeah.
You know, there's too much standing going on and it's gross. So that's become an issue. If you think it's an issue, some people don't, you know, so those are the main things. And then I guess the fifth thing would be you have to have a kind of curiosity about things that you haven't seen. And be willing to see anything within reason and want to discover things that you haven't seen that are from the past or from different, different countries, you know, different cultures, different areas of filmmaking, different styles of filmmaking, you know, avant-garde films, you know, foreign films, you know, art house films, documentaries, all these things. You know, you have to have a desire to find out about stuff that you don't know about.
How do things generally come to you? Is it publicists or are there other more unconventional ways that you find films to?
I mean, I get a lot of stuff from publicists, but that doesn't matter to me at all.
Yeah.
And in fact, if you're a film critic, you have to write about contemporary filmmaking and you have to engage with it, you know, in some way that's actually critical.
Yeah.
If you're only writing about old films, you know, then I don't think you're really a critic. That's something else in a way.
Yeah.
You're a historian.
Historian. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is a loose term now. Right.
Right. Of course.
I mean, it doesn't mean you have a PhD in cinema studies or something.
No.
But if you're not engaging with the reality of contemporary filmmaking in all its forms, you know, you should be doing that. So those are like five things that I think are important there.
Yeah.
And kind of in that order, you know, in a way. And the thing that when people are starting out as critics, the things that trip them up, I think, are they do want to see a lot of films, obviously.
Yeah.
And they sacrifice to see a lot of films because that's part of it too. But they don't work on being writers enough.
Yes, right.
And they also worry too much about being right.
Yeah. Can you expand on, what do you mean by that?
You know, they want to have the right opinion about everything, you know, in a way that is ultimately conformist, even if it's about films that are not that well known to people or, you know, are kind of, you know, minority tastes because they're too arty or, you know, I mean, everything besides Hollywood is kind of minority taste now in a way.
Sure.
But also people know so much more about older films now because of, you know, the Criterion Channel and MUBI and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
There's a much more expanded world of what the cinema is and can be now than there was, you know, in the 1990s. Because for most people back then, because they just couldn't get to a lot of this stuff, even though conversely more foreign films showed on screens back then.
Yeah.
So, you know, the desire to be right is something that hobbles people and is also kind of uninteresting.
Do you think there are writers that actually betray their real opinions?
That betray them?
Yeah, that write that don't that ignore what they really feel and try to be quote unquote right instead with
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yes, certainly that's true. Yeah.
Is there a novel or even a piece of nonfiction that you love that you feel is underappreciated that needs to be read?
Wow. Well, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things, I'm sure.
What comes to mind first?
Well, I can tell you writers that I came to cherish that I think are not canonical in some ways.
Yeah, that's good.
And a lot of those writers come from my time in the projection booth where I just read like the complete works of somebody as much as I could,
right,
you know,
as many
books as I could get my hands on, you know, for as little money as possible.
Right.
Some of the writers that I did that with that came to be like really important to me in my life are people who are very well known, but I think people don't think about them that much anymore. And one of them is J.G. Ballard, who I mentioned before.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the first author I kind of did that with was Samuel Beckett.
Oh yeah, okay.
And you know, Samuel Beckett just became this huge thing in my life. I read when I was in high school, I'd taken a date to see a production of Waiting for Godot in New Haven, Connecticut.
Oh wow.
And I hated it. I just hated it. I prefer movies to theater anyway. And it was awkward and I just didn't like it. It seemed pretentious to me.
Yeah.
And it would just seem pointless.
Yeah.
So I was at a yard sale around the time that I started being a projectionist in the early 90s, I guess. It was a yard sale that my friend was having, and he was selling a copy of the book Murphy by Samuel Beckett, which is Beckett's first novel. You know, it's one of those Grove Press paperbacks.
Yeah.
And they're very attractive.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, they are.
It had like big block letters. I just liked the way the cover of the book looked, you know?
Yeah.
And I was like, I've never read a novel by Samuel Beckett, you know? Maybe I should buy this from my friend. It's 50 cents. So I bought Murphy and I brought it back to read with me in the projection booth. And I was just so into it from the first sentence of that book. It has a very well-known first sentence now.
What is it?
It's about the sun rising like it always does. I can't quote it exactly.
Okay.
You know? It's just, I should be able to, but it's just this very surprising sentence to start a book with because it's banal, yet it's so original.
Yeah, yeah,
too.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's kind of world weary, but it's also gripping because, you know, who would say that, you know?
Yeah.
And after I read that book, I just read all his prose works, you know, kind of in order. And I became obsessed with Samuel Beckett, and I just wanted to read all his plays. I wanted to read, you know, biographies of him. I read the Deirdre Blair, or was it Bear, biography of him.
Yeah, right.
I loved it. And his life is just so fascinating. It was through this kind of immersive, you know, dive that was so deep and so dark, really, because it was in a projection booth.
Yeah.
Where you only have one reading light, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then the movie is playing and, you know, the shadows of the screen are in the booth with you. You know, it's kind of like being on a submarine and the ocean is outside.
Right. What a way to experience a writer like Beckett. Yeah.
Exactly. It was like the perfect thing for reading The Unnameable,
yeah,
for instance.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, where this figure is in this jar, you know? and then there was a book in the booth called Nothing More Than Murder by Jim Thompson.
Oh, cool. He's great.
And I had never read Jim Thompson, but the reason that that book was in the booth is because the protagonist is a movie theater projectionist.
Uh-huh. Right. Okay.
Who, you know, becomes a murderer.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I read that book because one of the other projectionists at the theater had left it there. And then I decided to read all the Jim Thompson novels, you know.
That's a dark journey.
And that is a dark journey. And they were kind of... They were all coming back into print around then.
The Black Lizard.
The the Black Lizard, you know,
yeah.
Trade paperbacks. You know, they have those beautiful covers.
Yeah.
So I started reading all of those that way too, you know. And then I did that with other writers too. I did it with Dawn Powell.
I don't know Dawn Powell.
Dawn Powell is a, you know, New York novelist from mostly the 20s, 30s, and 40s that wrote kind of, you know, her novels are kind of like reading All About Eve, if All About Eve was a novel.
I like it. I like it.
And, you know, they're all about New York literary figures and media figures at the time. You know, in one of her books, the, you know, this kind of evil protagonist is based on Claire Booth Luce.
Uh-huh.
And they're just really very smart, beautifully written, entertaining books about writers and artists and, you know, this kind of world of culture in New York in that period. And they're really great. And there's one called Turn Magic Wheel that I love. There's another one called The Locusts Have No King.
Great titles. Very evocative. Are they sort of like bitchy, bon mot, kind of queenie language like All About Eve is?
No. I mean, they're a little bit like that, but they're not... That's not their main thing. Uh-huh. They're just in beautifully written, you know, kind of limpid prose that really captures people.
Yeah, yeah.
Really well. And as with Jim Thompson, there was like a Dawn Powell revival then, and all her books are coming back into print.
Mm.
You know, so I read all those too.
Well, why don't we do this for these three authors? Tell our listeners the book that you think is the best to sort of enter them.
Well, for Samuel Beckett, it would be what's called the trilogy.
Okay.
Which is Molloy, Malone Dies, and The Unnameable.
Yeah.
Although I recommend Murphy, his first novel, too.
Okay.
And also Watt, W-A-T-T, his second novel, which is incredible. It's just, when you read something like that, you can't believe that people used to write novels like that, that are just... It's not like television, in other words. No one's going to make a limited series from a Beckett novel.
No. I don't know Watt, though. I've never heard of that one.
Yeah, well, that one was pretty obscure. But, you know, there's one large section of Watt that is just descriptions of different positions of chairs in a room. or the possible positions of chairs in a room.
Oh, wow.
That seems like it's this modernist anti... It's like anti-Henry James writing.
Yes, right.
You know?
Yeah.
It's just so, it's like very violent towards the idea of describing furniture in a room.
I love that.
For Jim Thompson, I guess, you know, The Killer Inside.
Yeah, that's the one, I suppose. Yeah.
Or the Grifters.
Yeah, both of them. What did you think of The Killer Inside Me adaptation with Casey Affleck, was it?
I did not see that, but I do enjoy the Stephen Frears Grifters adaptation with John Cusack and Angelica Houston,
yeah,
and Annette Bening.
Me too.
Although the novel's better because the nurse character in the novel is a Holocaust survivor.
That's right.
Which they cut that out of the film.
Yeah.
You know.
Too dark a backstory.
Well, I love those books. And Nothing More Than Murder, the one with the projectionist, of course.
Yeah.
And I don't know, who's the other author? J.G. Ballard?
Dawn Powell.
Oh, Dawn Powell. Oh, yeah. Well, Turn Magic Wheel and The Locusts Have No King. I would recommend those.
Great.
Two first, yeah. I mean, she was from Ohio, and she wrote a lot of books that kind of take place back in Ohio, in the small town that she's from. And she lived in New York City, and her New York novels are more interesting to me than her Ohio novels.
Mm, okay.
I mean, and I never really considered rereading the Ohio novels, but I have reread all the New York novels at one time or another.
And Turn Magic Wheel is one of the New York novels?
Oh yeah, that's a great book. That is an exciting book to read.
I love that title.
Those books are just great. And of course, you know, she was this very obscure figure. She was rediscovered by this guy, I guess, who's a music critic at the Washington Post, Tim Page.
Interesting.
And he wrote, I think he wrote a biography of her, which I read. I think he wrote that book.
Huh.
And then he brought her plays back into print too. And interestingly enough, Dawn Powell met Samuel Beckett.
Mm.
Which seems, you know, if you've read their work, they seem so different.
Mm.
But she knew, they had friends in common, and she met him when she went to Paris once. And also, one of her plays, she adapted into a film for Eric von Stroheim.
Wow. Everything's linking together here.
Yeah, and it was a film that was taken away from him. It was a sound film. And it was the film that kind of ended his career as a director in the U.S.
What was it?
And it was a film that made her want to not write screenplays or have anything to do with Hollywood anymore.
Wow. What's it called?
It was called Walking Down Broadway.
Wow.
And then I think the release title might have been different. I got to see that film at Film Forum. And it was really good. Someone else directed most of it, it turns out. I think it might have been Arthur Ripley. It was just a really underrated film, but it has this terrible reputation.
Yeah.
As being a dumb film that was ruined by the studio. And I really enjoyed it. And it's amazing that Dawn Powell and Von Stroheim were both involved in this.
That's really cool. Okay, thanks again to Scott for his time and for the conversation. I highly recommend finding old copies of Hermanot, the journal we discussed, if you can. That is spelled Hermenaut, Hermanot. I referenced the actor George Sanders, his suicide note at one point, so I thought I'd share it with you in its entirety. It goes, "Dear world, I am leaving you because I am bored. I feel I have lived long enough. I am leaving you with your worries in this sweet cesspool. Good luck." I love that. I think that's pretty good writing. This episode was recorded by me from my house in Los Angeles while Scott was at his house in Brooklyn. It was produced and edited by Justin Geller in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and facilitated by Lars Kreslins, also in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. The music is Bach, arranged and performed by Cyrus Garmani in Los Angeles. You can find more Apology stuff, such as the magazine, sometimes some merch, and show notes for these episodes, which I am still woefully behind on. I'm sorry about that. But you can find all that stuff at apologymagazine.com. So thanks. We'll see you again next time.